This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, just half of American adults are married, which is a sharp decline from the 1960s, when close to three-quarters of adults in the U.S. had tied the knot. And the institution of marriage today is certainly different than it was 60 years ago. I mean, just listen to this clip from the 60s-era family sitcom Leave It to Beaver.
Girls are kind of lucky, don't they, Mom?
Why do you say that?
Well, they don't have to be smart. They don't have to get jobs or anything. All they got to do is get married.
Well, Beaver, being smart isn't exactly a drawback to marriage.
Well, if they don't get married, well, they can become dressmakers or cut people's nails in a barbershop or take care of kids and a lot of other dumb stuff.
Well, Beaver, today girls can be doctors and lawyers, too, you know. They're just as ambitious as boys are.
You mean there's no dumb people left in the world, Mom?
Don't worry, Beaver. They will always be with us. That's from the sitcom Leave It to Beaver, and certainly our ideas about marriage have changed. Marriage rates have declined, but what do we know about the quality of marriages today? Are they better or worse than they used to be? My guest today argues the answer is both. While the average quality of marriages in America is in decline, he says the best marriages are better than ever before. He outlines this thesis in a new book, The All-or-Nothing Marriage, How the Best Marriages Work. Eli Finkel is a professor of psychology and a professor of management and organizations at Northwestern University, and he joins me now. Eli Finkel, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you for having me.
As we talk with Eli, we also want to hear from you. What do you want? What do you want to know about modern marriage? And do you have questions about how to get your own relationship back on track? You can call us. 877-962-9862. Send us an email at sot@wnc.org or tweet at us, hashtag SOTLive or hashtag AskFinkel, F-I-N-K-E-L. So, Eli Finkel, let's start with a bit of historical perspective, because you do that in your book, Marriage in America, and take us back to the outlines of the eras in American marriage anyway.
Yeah, there's been three primary eras of marriage in America. The first one started in the colonial era and went up until industrialization really started taking over in the mid-1800s. And in that first era, marriage was not primarily about love or personal fulfillment. People preferred to love their spouse, of course. But the institution, the relationship was too crucial for everyday survival, literally things like food production, shelter, health care. And so the idea that we would marry primarily for personal fulfillment, that was something that would come much later.
When did that enter the picture?
Yeah, so as society industrialized, as American culture industrialized, really in the second half of the 1800s, we saw two major changes. The first is it became easier to meet the most basic needs without being married. So a local crop failure used to be, you know, a life-threatening situation, but then, of course, there were trains that could bring crops in from elsewhere and so forth. So life became a little less precarious. And the second thing that industrialization brought is a surfeit of jobs to urban centers. And so for the first time anywhere ever, young people were geographically and economically independent from their parents, which means they had greater freedom in making marital decisions. And this launched the second era of marriage in America, which we call the love-based era. And in that era, the point of marriage really increasingly revolved around love and affection.
And you also describe this era as a moment in which the human psyche was cleaved in half. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so the ideal of the love-based marriage had this additional component to it, which was this breadwinner homemaker way of thinking about family life. And so the idea is, as we know from shows like Leave It to Beaver, the idea was that the father was assertive but not particularly nurturing, and the mother was nurturing but not particularly assertive. And if it had been the case that women and men really are fundamentally different in such a profound way, then maybe it wouldn't have been problematic that we made men be non-nurturing and women be unassertive. But the reality is that both men and women have both nurturing and assertive sides of their personalities, of their senses of self. And so yeah, so as we divided men and women into separate spheres, starting in the 1850s, but really it reached its peak in the 1950s, we did cleave the human psyche in half, sort of creating two half-developed individuals rather than two fully developed individuals.
And so you call this period that we're living in now the period of the all-or-nothing marriage. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, that's right. So the basic idea of the all-or-nothing marriage is that the best marriages are better than we've ever seen before, and the average marriage at the same time is actually getting worse. So we're seeing some divergence where the best marriages are really strong, whereas, you know, more and more of us are actually, you know, limping along a little bit.
All right, so what makes a good marriage? What makes those best marriages really, really strong?
Well, what I think is interesting is that the same trend actually caused both the best marriages to get better and the average marriages to get a little bit worse. And that trend is, as we arrived at this third era of marriage, which really started in the 1960s and then we could call a self-expressive era, we no longer were satisfied with just love, right? So for the first time ever, you start to hear people saying things like, well, he's a lovely man and a good father and I respect him, but I feel stagnant in the marriage and I'm not going to stay like that for the next 30 years. And so there's this emphasis these days that the marriage not only should be a place of love, but also a place of personal growth and movement toward a more authentic, ideal self sort of existence. So the issue is that makes it harder to achieve a good marriage. That means that a marriage that would have been sufficient to meet our expectations in the 1950s falls short of our expectations today, and more of us are disappointed. But at the same time, those high expectations put within reach a level of marital fulfillment that was out of reach in an era that we weren't even trying to achieve those sorts of things. And so it's those marriages that are looking for these, you know, really deep levels of emotional fulfillment and actually achieving those things that are so profoundly fulfilling today.
And herein, it seems to me, lies the great paradox of this thing we call love. And that is, for this, I think, you use Maslow's hierarchy of needs as a way of understanding the evolution of marriage just in this country. The idea that we start with a root need to stay alive and be nurtured and fed. And then, but ultimately, the highest level of this chart takes us to self-actualization. And here is where the riddle occurs. You know, how do we actualize the self and be engaged in what should be a self-giving relationship if it's truly loving?
Yeah, this is a good point, right? So the Maslow's hierarchy does talk about self-actualization, and I myself do talk in the book about trying to become, you know, close to the ideal self. But there's nothing in the ideal self that is necessarily selfish. Right. So it is true that it is a model of marriage that looks at the self, that tries to help us grow into an ideal or a more authentic version of ourselves. But I don't think there are very many perspectives on the self that would say the best we can do under those circumstances is become as selfish as we can. And by and large, those of us who are living lives that we feel like are particularly fulfilling and we're aligning our daily life with our ideal self typically are generous. We're worrying about things that are much larger than ourselves. And one of the things that we often want to do these days is, in order to achieve a sense of personal fulfillment, a lot of us are trying to build and sustain a high quality marriage, even when that's difficult.
I'm talking to Eli Finkel, the author of The All or Nothing Marriage. We're also taking your calls at 877-962-9862, emails at sot@wnc.org, and you can tweet at us at hashtag SOTLive or Ask Finkel, F-I-N-K-E-L. And we've got a question already along these lines. Vincent from Carborough wants to know that if we're in love and we still feel, you know, if we are in love, will we feel satisfied and happy, or can you be in love and unhappy?
Well, so this gets to a semantic issue surrounding the phrase in love. So it depends how we want to think about that phrase. So most of us are happy when we're in a relationship where we feel like we are in love and the person that we love is in love with us. And that tends to be a relatively strong relationship, at least during that period of time. Now, being in love, right? So we can contrast that a little bit with feeling like you love someone, right? So I love this person, but I'm not in love with this person. So it's a distinction that you probably wouldn't have heard in 1950, but we hear today. And often in love has this element of not only feeling like we have great emotional affection for the person, but also feeling like there's a deeper, more holistic sort of connection there, often including this sense of, I love who I am when I'm with you. I feel like I'm growing to be the best version of myself. So if those are the experiences that we're having when we're in love, then it looks like we're having the sort of relationship that I'm so enthusiastic about these days, which is that we're looking for the marriage to do all these sorts of things for us, and we're one of the fortunate ones where the marriage is actually providing all of that for us.
And this seems to me also to get to another of the great paradoxes, which is the way you feel when you meet someone. And generally speaking, that feeling of goodness and happiness, if we go back to Vince's term here, feeling happy, has to do with how you make me feel. Like, when I look at you, you know, I get this really nice feeling. That's not the same as marriage, which is has to do with, like, getting the socks out of the way for the third time this week, right? So the evolution of developing a relationship, a lot of that feeling may or may not last, but then the relationship might look entirely different because it's based on something else. Am I onto something here?
Yeah, relationship researchers make distinction between, you know, different flavors of love. And what you're talking about in those early throes of a new relationship, you know, we often refer to as something like romantic passion. And you're absolutely right. In most cases, romantic passion lasts a couple of years. It's pretty useful in terms of getting us to fall in love with someone and start developing a deeper bond with that person. But very few people are as passionate about their spouse 20 years in. Very few people are having as much sex or even desiring as much sex 20 years in as they were at first. And this is one of the reasons why marriage is a slog. It's a difficult thing to do. It's also one of the things that's beautiful about the decision to marry, right? We decide that we're going to make a commitment to this person. And even as we grow and even as passion is likely to fade, at least to some degree, we're resolving that we're going to try to grow together, even when it's difficult. And even when we have to work at it, we're going to try to make this thing work. And again, it's one of the things that I'm most awed by is how many of us are willing to take that flying leap, that risky flying leap, and trying to make the best of it.
Well, it looks like Chris is on the verge of making that flying leap and may have a question for us. Chris is on the line. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Frank. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've gone through marriage counseling. I'm supposed to be married on the 27th of next month, and Gary Chapman's got the 5 love languages. We're a young couple, and I guess as we're talking about as far as like the third time getting the socks out of the way, I'm trying to figure out what else, or I'm trying to just get insight on what else can we do to kind of move away from that selfishness of still like our young, immature ways and move towards like the selflessness and just be successful as a couple, you know, as a couple. And
well, it's a great question. Let's, Eli, what do you think? I mean, it is an interesting question in a way, because what do you do with the idea that I got this great feeling now, and Eli just told me I'm not going to have it forever. So what should I be looking for? How do I know that this is really the person when that feeling fades away? It's a great question. Thanks, Chris.
Yeah, I mean, this is why I talk about marriage as like a beautiful leap of faith, right? There are no guarantees, and it's one of the beautiful things that we do is we say, yes, there are no guarantees, and yet here I am and here you are, and let's do this thing. I do want to make a distinction between something that is oriented toward the self or relevant to fulfilling the self and something that is necessarily selfish. And this is one of the issues that I do tackle in the book. Is for a long time, I mean, going back to the 1700s, people were concerned that once marriage became about personal fulfillment, it actually would become incompatible with the idea of marital commitment. Like, if the point of marriage is to make you feel like happy and pleasured, then why would you stick with a marriage during those inevitable periods that are actually difficult and challenging and aren't that fun? And it turns out that there's more than one way of thinking about personal fulfillment, even if you're talking about the self. And so one of them is about like having things be easy and pleasurable. And I do think that that is incompatible with marital commitment. That is, if you're really trying to build a marriage that's just sort of easy and pleasurable and doesn't really have hardness in it, then you will end up disappointed. And you're at risk, I think, for having a marriage that ends in divorce, or at least that disappoints you quite a bit. But there's another version of personal fulfillment. And instead of talking about, you know, pleasure and maybe just feeling good and feeling good about the self, you could talk about meaning and purpose. Right. And so if we're trying to develop not necessarily a life filled with pleasure, but a life filled with meaning and purpose, frequently oriented towards something greater than the self, then there's no longer any incompatibility between trying to achieve personal fulfillment and trying to achieve marital commitment, especially because building and sustaining a long-term marriage is one way through which a lot of us seek to reach a meaningful, purposeful life. And so I guess to conclude that, I would encourage people who are about to take the leap to jettison the goal that marriage will be a chronic bed of roses, and instead think of it as something that will be lovely and beautiful and difficult, and that conquering the difficulties will be one of the ways through which we can grow to build a meaningful, purposeful life.
But here's another way to look at that paradox that Christine writes. Christine comes into us, has sent us a message on Twitter and says, quote, "I think marriage means you give up a piece of yourself no matter how good it is. You always have to be willing to compromise." Again, this may be a matter of language, but I wonder what your take on that statement is.
You know, I think it's a reasonable statement, but you're right. I have a slightly different perspective on it, or at least would frame it differently. I don't really think marriage has to be about giving up. I think it is correct that marriage will require some amount of sacrifice. I hope that the sacrifices that people make in their marriages don't feel like sacrifices to their sense of self. Ideally, you can make sacrifices that are more toward the periphery, that don't actually force you to compromise who you are, the most authentic version of yourself. The best marriages certainly shouldn't ask that of you. And so, yes, I mean, compromising is one thing, and certainly making sacrifices in order to smooth everyday life and to make your partner happy, those are terrific things that we should be doing in our marriage. Sacrificing really something core for ourselves for the marriage, that one is tougher, and I would be wary of offering general advice. It would be a case-by-case sort of situation.
Maybe this gets easier if you have a better working definition of love. If you think about some of the deeper and more ancient mystical ideas from every tradition, it seems to me, one way or another, all of the great mystical and spiritual traditions have a version of the golden rule that really emphasizes the self and the other, right? You love your neighbor as yourself. That's not an order of operations. You don't start with yourself and then go to the neighbor. This means that seeing yourself in the other allows both of you to be fulfilled, so that knowing that your identity is, in fact, in the other means you don't have to give up a thing. There they are.
Yeah.
There you are, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's an excellent way of thinking about this stuff. You know, among people who study this stuff for a living, like I do, yeah, we try to tackle a lot of these interrelated themes and feelings, motivations that surround the word love. And one distinction I like comes from attachment theory, a theory developed by a guy named John Bowlby back in the mid-20th century. And he talks about two major functions that we serve for our loved ones and that they serve for us, one being a safe haven, which is a place where you know that you can go when life deals you something difficult, when you're ashamed of something that happened from work, something that happened at work, or you're feeling sick, or you're just feeling like you're not living up to what you hoped you could be. You go to the person, and that person can function as a safe haven for you, like a harbor for you. And the other function is a secure base, right? So the idea is that yes, your loved one, your spouse, for example, is a place where you can go when you're feeling vulnerable and you need tenderness and nurturance and care, but it's also a secure base where that you can go off and take adventures and take risks and feel like, okay, I'm going to take a flying leap here. I know that you're back there and that you have my back, and I can go out into the world and try to be ambitious and adventurous, because I know that you're back there.
Eli, and I'm going to forgive me, I'm going to take a break right here, and then we're going to come back, take more phone calls, emails, and tweets when I talk with Eli Finkel, professor of psychology, the author of the new book, The All or Nothing Marriage. You can send us an email at sot@wnc.org, call us at 877-962-9862, or tweet us at #SOTLive. When we come back, please stay tuned. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Saying I do is a commitment that fewer Americans are making now than these days, at least, than in generations past. And while some may say the institution of marriage is in decline, my guest today argues that the best marriages today are, in fact, better than ever before. Eli Finkel is a professor of psychology at Northwestern University and the author of the new book, The All or Nothing Marriage. And as we continue our conversation with him, we also want to hear from you. What do you want to know about modern marriage? And do you have questions about how to get your own relationship back on track or keep it there? 877-962-9862, sot@wnc.org is the email address, #SOTLive, or Ask Finkel, F-I-N-K-E-L. And let's go to the phones right now where Leslie is on the line. Hello, Leslie.
Hi. I just was wondering if you believe that a marriage is required to achieve that really fulfilling and self-actualizing type of relationship, or if you think a couple can achieve that kind of without that contract, if you will.
Thanks, Leslie.
No, I don't think marriage is required. One of the things that's remarkable about America, though, is we're really all in on marriage. I'm not saying that every single American is, but if you compare us to, say, Canada or, you know, other Western European nations, for example, you know, we tend to prioritize the relationship, prioritize marriage in particular quite a bit. So, no, I don't think there's something that is required where you have to get the sort of legal or even religious sanction in order to have one of these relationships. But the truth is, it's the path that most of us these days still want to take.
Is there anything about marriage as an institution going back as far as it does, right, in dragging forward sort of cultural artifacts that may no longer be relevant? Is there a way in which marriage might inhibit the development of that relationship? There's something constraining about it.
Yes and no. So I do think that that we, you know, so we develop this perception of what marriage is like, and that's culturally and historically relative in ways that we really fail to appreciate. We think that Leave It to Beaver was traditional marriage, but the truth is the 1950s type of marriage was like an eye blink in historical time. It was a really strange period where, I mean, some historians refer to it as the great exception. So yes, we grow up into a particular time, and because we grow up in a particular time, in a particular place, we have a particular set of ideas for how we're supposed to behave in our marriage. But never has there been as much flexibility about the way a marriage has to work as there is today. So you can get married or you can not get married, and you can get married. And then if you need to, or if you feel like you need to divorce, you can get divorced without having, you know, huge amount of social shame like in the past. And then if you think about how you want to get married and the way that you want to relate to your spouse, there's a tremendous amount of freedom for that too. So I am pretty optimistic that most of us can make a marriage work with what our preferences are in terms of whom we'd like to marry and how we'd like to interact. Although there may well be the occasional exception to that.
Let's go back to the phones now where Don is on the line. Hello, Don.
Hello. I was asking about the current phase of the generational marriage. It started in 1960. Are you noticing any shift in the commitment or purpose of marriage with regard to the millennials and their acceptance through the interracial marriage as well as same-sex marriage?
Thank you, Don.
The brief answer is yes. So let's call it 1965 or so when we started this third era of marriage that I think we're still in. But the period hasn't, you know, been monolithic. It's not like in 1965 we had one change and it's been like that ever since. The 1965 was really the starting point where we really valued individual autonomy, self-expression, personal growth, and that these were things that we really looked to our marriage to help us achieve and that we hope to help our spouse achieve. And in the 60s and the 70s, this new approach pretty much shattered marriage. I mean, the divorce rate doubled from about 25% to 50% in the 60s and the 70s. And there was a sociologist in the late 70s who observed if current trends continue, there won't be an intact family in America by the 1990s. And, you know, that's the part in the book where I say, look, we need a sobriety check. We need to take a moment and say, huh, you know, it looked like we were shattering the institution and we were going to have to figure out what comes next. But I think we've developed a new way of dealing with this self-expressive approach to marriage. So it did shatter things in the 60s and the 70s. But starting in the 1980s, and I think increasingly, we've done better as a society in figuring out how we're going to build stable family lives, stable marital unions with this self-expressive emphasis. But with regard to, you know, millennials and interracial marriage and so forth, the reality is once you really prioritize marriage that's built around love, and once you really prioritize a marriage that's built around self-expression and personal growth and authenticity, I think you almost inevitably get to looser definitions of marital and family life. And so it seems to follow almost necessarily that you can approve of interracial marriages, that you can approve of same-sex marriages and so forth, because the institution really isn't about the old sacraments that it was about in, say, 1800. It's really about living authentic, meaningful lives. And if you're going to live an authentic life and you are gay, for example, it's hard to have an institution where heterosexuals say, look, we get to live authentic lives, but you, gay person, you don't get to live authentic lives. So I think a lot of this, what I think a lot of people would call social progress or social change, at least, was almost inevitable once we, that is heterosexuals, redefined how marriage works.
Well, as you say that also, it may be one of the things that's saving marriage as an institution, because it did drag forward so many cultural, you know, archaic cultural artifacts that it was in danger of dying because it was no longer relevant. Once you update it, perhaps these new permissions are actually what's saving marriage. And so, contrary to what the critics might be saying, it doesn't ruin marriage. In fact, it's probably responsible for keeping it alive.
I think you're exactly right. I know. I really think that's right. Is that once these ideas came, the countercultural ideas that really launched in the 1960s, right? I mean, this was the era of the civil rights movement and the feminist movement and birth control pill. And once you had a generation that was raised with those sorts of ideas and those sorts of circumstances, it's hard to imagine them fitting back within the box of Beaver Cleaver's parents, right? That is, the institution needed to change if it was going to work with the generation that came of age in the 60s and all of the subsequent generations.
If for no other reason than we found it's impossible to do housework in high heels. That's what I've learned anyway. Let me ask
I've tried it. It's fun to try. You don't give up.
Okay. I'll give it one more shot. talk about love hacks. Let's get down to advice to the lovelorn. Let's do that, Eli. We're doing the show. What should we do? Give us some kind of quick advice on, and you do in the book too. You talk about simple things that we can do to really refresh and examine our marriage, keep it going.
That's right. I mean, the book, it gives a historical perspective, and it introduces this all or nothing theory of marriage, and then it takes the logic of this theory that says that, you know, the best marriages are better than ever. On average, marriages are struggling a bit. How can more of us do better? How can more of us have more meaningful, longer lasting, fulfilling marriages? And the logic of the all or nothing marriage idea that we've been talking about, you know, over the last, I don't know, 20 minutes or so, it is in some sense a supply and demand model. It says you're allowed to ask or demand whatever you want of your marriage. It doesn't tell you to have lower expectations or higher expectations. It says you can demand what you want, but you really don't want to demand things that the marriage can't provide. And so the demands are what you're asking of the marriage, and the supply is what the marriage can realistically provide. And it turns out that if you think that way, you can try to invest more in the marriage to try to add supply to meet what you're asking of it. Or you can ask less of the marriage in order to make sure that you're not disappointed given what the marriage can actually provide. And then you've talked about this idea of love hacks, which is a third option, which is, are there quick and dirty things that we can do that don't require us to give up our aspirations for the marriage, but that we can use even when life is busy and chaotic to make marriage just a little bit stronger?
So give us an example. You talk about making sure you hold hands, not listening for the worst in or expecting the worst from a relation or a reaction from a spouse, and some of the other really kind of quick tips for keeping things
strong.
Yeah,
the quick and dirty stuff. I mean, I talk about
you can emphasize. By the way, you can emphasize the dirty here because
these are both quick and also dirty.
Okay.
So the book talks about 8 different love hacks. All of these are based on evidence, right? All of these are science based procedures that psychologists have identified over the last 10 years or so. And you can do them without your partner's knowledge, without even your partner having to be involved with you, and they don't take much time. So one of my favorites is one that we actually developed in our lab, which is how do you deal with conflict, right? So obviously there's all sorts of really good solutions to conflict, and I talk about a lot of those when I talk about how people can go all in trying to make their marriage as strong as possible. But are there quick and dirty things we can do? It turns out that thinking about conflict from the perspective of a neutral third party who wants the best for everybody is something that can actually strengthen the marriage, not only in terms of feeling happier in the marriage, but also in terms of making us feel a little bit more passionate in our marriage, which is, again, something of a holy grail in trying to make marriages better. It's hard to increase levels of passion, but it looks like this procedure of adopting a neutral, generous third-party perspective during conflict can accomplish quite a bit.
I also like what you say about gratitude. That can be so difficult in a marriage of any number of years because you take things for granted. So when somebody
That's right.
takes out the trash and that suddenly becomes their job, it's like, oh, the trash got taken out. You didn't even think about it. You just say, thanks for taking out the trash.
Yeah, I mean, the love hacks, all of the love hacks are inspired by Marcel Proust's observation that mystery is not about traveling to new places, but about looking with new eyes. Mm. And so there's a set of procedures that we can use to try to just look with generous new eyes at the everyday, at the mundane. And you give a good example, right? So there's research that randomly assigns people to various conditions. And one of the conditions is think about ways that your partner has made sacrifices for the relationship. And it turns out that people who write about that, who actually take just a few minutes to think about those sorts of things, end up being more grateful and happier and feel more committed to their relationship than people assigned to think about other sorts of things. Now, I ask the listeners, you know, do you have 5 minutes a month to think about ways that your partner has actually really invested in the relationship? It's a nice thing to feel grateful and to feel happy in the relationship.
I'm going to go back to the phones now. Carlisle is on the phone and has a comment for us. Hello, Carlisle. Are you there?
Hello?
Hello, Carlisle.
Yes.
Do you have a comment for us?
I do. Joe and I have been married 54 years, and we, of course, had some ups and downs over those years. But what we came up with is that we have to look at the total package. And when we look at the total package, we have a wonderful marriage. So just...
Well, what does it mean, Carla? Let me ask you, because I think I know the Joe you're talking about, and now that you say it, I think I know who you are. But let me ask you what do you mean the whole package? What do you mean the whole package? Is, you know, he was a busy guy. He was in the church a lot. So what do you mean the whole package?
Well, like, for instance, he loves to stay up late at night. I love to go to bed early. So we have to find time that we want to be in bed together. I like to be careful what I eat, and he likes to just enjoy it, not like the thought whether it's really good for him. Although, since he had his heart problem, he is doing better on that.
He's getting smarter, huh? Well, that gives us an idea. Thank you for the comment, Carlisle. Thank you
okay.
so much, and say hi
okay.
to Joe.
Bye-bye.
But this gets back, I think, Eli, to what you were saying, is you suddenly become conscious or more aware and mindful of what the other is doing and how you relate to each other instead of being stuck in what you think are your habits, which are should be universally accepted.
Yeah, I mean, she illustrated a number of really interesting ideas. One of the things that we talked about just briefly is the idea that we can ask a little bit less. That is, there are places where we can say, look, you know, it might have been nice if I had somebody who went to bed at the same time as I did. I like pillow talk, and it's nice to, you know, snuggle before bedtime, but you know, he likes to go to bed late, and that's something that I can give up and doesn't feel too agonizing for me, and I can focus on other things. And she, it sounds like, does a terrific job of being willing to make some sacrifices, not even really experiencing them as strong sacrifices, and then focusing on the strength of the marriage and the connection that they have, and really savoring and appreciating those strengths. Too many of us are pretty bad about doing that. We're not good at even on a day-to-day basis saying, you know, we're really lucky to have found each other, and here's a couple reasons why. She seems like she's just totally got it.
I've only left you about a minute and a half for this, but there's questions here that revolve around monogamy and whether or not it's natural and we should even aspire to this. And there's really a second question I think is tangentially related, which is that it, quote, takes a village to raise a child, rings true for raising children. Is there something about our isolated lifestyles that makes it more difficult for us to manage marriage, for which a monogamous marriage in particular? Do we have greater capacity, and are we cutting ourselves short?
Well, let me tackle the child rearing thing, and if we end up with some time, we can get into the more controversial stuff as well. One thing that we don't sufficiently appreciate, but the data, the evidence is just unbelievably clear, is that the transition from not being a parent to having a newborn is difficult. It is difficult in a lot of ways. It is difficult in significant ways. And one of the ways in which it's difficult is that our connection with our spouse suffers, not forever, but for quite a while. And, you know, it's how much time we have for each other, the number of things we have to coordinate, and that means the number of things that are potentially sources of fights, the frequency that we have sex with our partner. All of these things really plummet with the arrival of the first kid. And so I think this is one of those periods where, you know, when I talked about places where you might be able to lower expectations a little bit, one of the times that is just absolutely essential to try to regulate or modulate expectations, not forever, but for a while, is as you adjust to becoming parents for the first time. It's a difficult time, and if you're expecting everything from before the marriage to before the kid to be the same, you'll find yourself disappointed, and there's ways to avoid that.
Monogamy, yes or no? You've only got 3 seconds.
More yes than no. More yes than no.
Okay. Eli Finkel is a professor. Thank you so much for being with us on this program.
Yeah, it's fun. Thanks for having me.
Eli Finkel is a professor of psychology at Northwestern University. He is the author of the new book, The All or Nothing Marriage, How Best Marriages Work. He is going to be in conversation with behavioral economist Dan Ariely at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill on Monday, October 2nd. You can find out more about that event and more about Eli's research at our website, stateofthings.org. The State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton-Ormond, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.